Welcome back to Mental Health Matters. We got another great show for you today. We're with Ellison, and we are honored to be blessed by Ellison's presence one more time before she takes off on her grand journey. And we're going to talk about Ellison's grand journey, about stories, and about how we create our stories in this life.
Yes. How, and about stories as therapy. As you have mentioned, Terry, there's such a thing as narrative therapy, which is based on the premise that if you change the story you tell yourself about yourself, your life will change.
Absolutely. This is Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry. And let's see, on KRUU 100.1 on your FM dial, where you could look up some of the archives of these old shows. KRUUFM.com, or you could go to Ardent Center's website, www.ardentcenter.com, and go to the media tab and pull up stories there. Or you could email me, scott@ardentcenter.com. Ardent is A-R-D-E-N-T. C-N-T-E-R.com, about any shows, any questions, any thoughts, or anything else. All right. So, Ellison.
Yes. Terry.
All right. So, we're going to talk today about, let's start with that notion of narrative therapy. What does that actually mean? Because in my world, we think of narrative therapy as reinventing that language, that sense of how we say what we're saying to ourselves, mm-hmm. let alone to our partners, to our friends, to our families, to our world around us, to our bosses. It's not just what we say, but who we are when we say it. What does those words mean to us?
Right.
Right? And, you know, and it's also, I think, sometimes we don't get lost in those words. So you have a child,
mm-hmm.
and when that child's young, and you're trying to be an appropriate mother.
Oh, I never try to be an appropriate mother.
I'm going to assume the best of you, and you're going to have some structure for that child sometimes. And the child's going to say, I don't want that structure. I don't want to go to sleep. I don't want to have to do this. I hate you, mommy. And they say those negative, destroying words. You don't get trapped by those words.
Well, words, you know, words are a very interesting place to go because I speak for a living. I love words. I always have. I love to play with words. And yet, and as you're saying, words carry, you know, they carry subtext and metatext. They carry memory and history. They carry tonality. In one sense, people are always saying something because even if they're not using words, their whole, you know, they're like a little radio tower. They're being emits frequencies that tell us things about how they feel, what they think, their history, etc. In classical Vedic thought, there are four levels of speech. And the grossest level of speech is the spoken word. Then there
what,
are...
What, yes, please tell us all of them.
So the grossest level, the level of speech is called vaikari. Then there is madhyama, which is a middle level of speech, which is a more nasalized kind of speech. You can hear it many times when people chant Sanskrit, that they're speaking more out of their nose than out of their mouth. Then there is Pashyanti, which is mental thought. And then the finest is Para, which is purely telepathic speech. Classically, Vaikari is regarded as both the grossest form of speech and the most limiting, precisely because words become very, actual spoken words, written words, become very tricky to use because of the way different individuals ascribe meaning. It's much harder to lie to you with my eyes, for instance, than it is with my mouth. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
or with my whole being. To lie with your whole being is part of good acting, essentially. But words become very slippery, tricky things, and they become very individualized, too, in terms of what people make them mean. So as far as, like, you know, use the example of being a mother. People, I do see people tell their children not to say, I hate you. I would never tell a child not to say that because I would immediately think of the message behind it, which is that being is basically stating, I experience you as an invasive limiting force and I object.
Mm.
And so it doesn't, you know, And the shortest way for a child to say that is, I hate you. Mm. And even if a child did hate me, why do I care? Like, why would I even take that personally?
Why? And I think that's the point, is we get stuck in that. Or our partner, right? We're in a fight, and our fight, and our partner says the nuclear option. I hate you, and I'm getting a divorce. I want you to leave. Whatever the incredible negative thing to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a client the other week, and she was telling me how she was called these horrible names, the worst mm-hmm. names that a woman could be called
mm-hmm.
by another woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so distraught over the words.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in fact, we started in session playing with those words.
Right.
Those very negative phrases
right.
that I couldn't pronounce on the air. I can't even say those on the air, because they're so vitriolic, they're so negative, they're so destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And by almost empowering herself and taking back control over those words, it wasn't like exposure therapy, which you do with people that are traumatized sometimes, and almost becoming numb to your experience, but taking those words and going, no, I'm taking back my power into me now.
Right.
It's just like in a relationship where I'm afraid to go to my favorite restaurant because that's where I went to with my partner, who mm-hmm. I'm no longer with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, how do I retake back my power?
Mm-hmm.
How do I retake back my words, my language, my, you know, that these words not only have meaning, but they're productive.
Right, and playfulness can be one way, both of reclaiming meaning and of realizing that there are other layers to meaning, as I'm saying. I mean, words are often, words are so many things. In the Mahabharata, which is this Indian epic, they have spaceships that are powered by mantra. You have to know the right word to say to get the spaceship to fly. Like, in so words, you know, words serve
it's
as
like a magic spell.
Word, right. Words serve as missiles. All words are spells in some sense. Words serve as missiles. So we behind the word, though, usually is also an energetic impact, you know, because if someone says the same word to us with deep love that, you know, that
so
someone else
contextual.
Says with, hey, it becomes very contextualized.
Absolutely. So one of the words that I discussed with this particularly powerful and insightful, brilliant woman, and I'm going to call it out as a woman, is she's been reading this new book that's come out recently. So this is going to be a difficult word for some people. So the book is called Pussy.
Mm-hmm.
And by taking that back,
mm-hmm.
that energy back, she's empowered herself
mm-hmm.
as a woman, as opposed to hiding from her sexuality, which she had been doing, and to empower herself,
mm-hmm.
that again change the contextuality, change the power of those words to enliven herself as opposed to being destructive. The words themselves aren't the power, it's the intentionality often behind those words.
Right.
What I'm doing with those words, right?
Right. And what the general culture is doing with the words, too. And, you know, female sexuality has been something that is, you know, certainly been through its traumas. So,
and even more so lately, and through our presidential election and through all kinds of things. So, you know, how do you as a female re-empower yourself? How do you take back your power back into you now? So
mm-hmm.
you have control and choice over what's going on with those words, with that meaning behind. Maybe somebody else had implied some negative word to you.
Right. Well, there's often, see, it's interesting because if we think about words for female genitalia that are used as slurs, the reason why they work as a slur to begin with is because of the sense that female genitalia are in some sense inherently shameful to begin with,
exactly.
or inherently wrong to begin with. So there are many layers to taking back power. There's taking back, and you can certainly start with the words as an avenue or a portal, but there's reclaiming self-definition as there being nothing inherently wrong with female genitalia.
Absolutely.
So,
well, you know, and I think that's key. Is it's like, let's get to the deeper level. Let's pull back that onion, and the deeper level there, which, you know, as you're so perfectly saying, is what's really behind it. And so let's say culturally, people have said, you're a woman, you should be ashamed or hide or secretive or dismissive of your own sexuality.
Right.
And your sexual elements.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean you've got to go over to the other side and say, well, if I'm free, I could do whatever I want. Well, that might be true, but is the contextual situation of the society ready for that to change? Or is that not the question?
Well, society is usually not ready to change, but sometimes individuals are. Or, you know, society will change when it will change, when the wave is big enough. But and this is an interesting issue that we've come to narrative therapy and sexuality, because sexuality is such a potent force in human life. You know, they say that there are three fundamental animal urges that humans have to regulate or deal with if they want to raise their consciousness: food, sex, and sleep. Okay. So each one becomes a way of becoming duller and more sleepy. Obviously, food. If you eat a heavy meal, you'll know right away that your consciousness is operating at a low. It's people who sleep in later, their consciousness is operating at a low. One of the ways to lighten your consciousness is to consistently get up before sunrise, because there is a special energy that rises when the sun rises. And if you are awake to experience it, your own mind-body consciousness will be lighter for the day. And then the third is sex, because sex is, unless you have mastered the art of raising consciousness with sexual energy, which is no mean feat, no little practice, sex itself will tend to drag down your consciousness or make it lower. So this point of, simply because I've gone beyond being ashamed of being a woman or being ashamed of my genitalia, it's very reactionary to think that, oh, well, then that then means like I'm going to go have sex with whoever I want, because that's a different kind of poison in its own right.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I would say, as a therapist, that it becomes a trap on either side.
Right.
So again, if I'm in a society which I'm wanting to connect with people, but I'm going to be in denial about my sexuality, and I'm going to say I'm going to be celibate in a society that is not celibate, that in fact people connect through sexuality, then that becomes incredibly troublesome.
Not necessarily. Not if celibacy is something that a being chooses consciously and wants for themselves. Why is that troublesome?
Well, again, if it's a sense of how am I utilizing, again, it's application. So if I'm in denial about my sexuality, then I think it's troublesome. I think if I'm utilizing and I'm choosing, I'm taking that energy and using that sexuality in a different way, if I'm taking that energy and manifesting in a different way, then I don't think it's troublesome.
Right.
I don't think it's the sexuality that's the troublesome part. I think it's the application.
Correct.
So if I am overexerting, I'm not going to be ashamed of my sexuality, as we said, and I'm going to sleep with whomever I want, whenever I want, which, okay, I honor that sense of freedom that you have, but there's a cost to that.
A huge cost.
And
especially as a woman, because for men, you know, this comes down to a simple physical difference, at least among, you know, heterosexual people, which is that the act of penetrating versus the act of being penetrated, because you know, part of the cost of that is essentially being a sperm toilet.
Okay. And that sperm toilet thought. Well, you know, but I, you know, okay, so that's one way to say it. But I think, okay, if I am on the receiving end of sexuality, there's both good and bad to accepting somebody else's energy, so to speak. And there's good elements to being with somebody's energy if you're accepting that, if you're wanting that. Again, let me pick an extreme example here. what's the difference between rape and loving sexuality, loving sexual connection?
Right.
It's the same act, so to speak.
Yes, it is.
What's the difference?
Yes, yes. And where does that difference begin? I always say, too, where is the spectral difference, you know, between, you know, acceptable sexuality and perversion? Because people have very different ideas on this, very,
absolutely,
very different individual ideas. So it really depends, again, on what the being thinks their life is about, or what the being theoretically, you know, wants their life to be about. Although even we may want to question our desires. So yes, where does the spectrum end between rape and loving sexuality?
By the way, you're listening to KRUU 100.1 on your FM dial, Mental Health Matters with Dr. Scott Terry. And today we're with Allison, so lovely that she's able to join us again before she goes on her incredible adventure, which she's going to tell us about in a second. And today we're talking about narrative. What does words mean and how are we utilizing them? And how else would you say this?
How can words be used in creative and playful ways to free people from painful limitations?
And then the implications of those words, as we're just talking about sexuality for a second, you know, I mean, the implications of women's genitalia and how that leads to sexuality, and then what are we doing with that?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I would also come back to contextuality again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Contextual notions are king in my world.
Yes, what it means rather than what it is. It's always what it means.
What does it mean?
So what is
between
intended?
Loving sex, of connecting with my partner who I desire deeply,
mm-hmm,
versus rape.
Right.
Or sexuality, overt sexuality. Well, if I'm in, you know, 100, 200 years ago and I'm showing my ankles, now I'm overly sexualized.
Or even in some parts of the world today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and it becomes too easy to sit there and view somebody else's contextuality from your contextuality, which I think is always, always damaging. You know, somebody's wearing a hijab, and again, I'm judging them as, why are you covering yourself up? Why are you doing that to yourself? You are dishonoring yourself by covering yourself.
Right. And, you know, as the famous saying goes, don't judge a man until you've walked a mile, or a woman, until you've walked a mile in her hijab, because, or chador, or whatever it is called, because, you know, that way you'll be a mile away and you'll have good cover over you when that person gets mad at you for judging them.
I love that. But I think that's the case. I mean, so how do we take back that power? How do you take back those words? How do you get where you're at, who you are?
And can you take back, too, the poison darts that were thrown with the words? Can you own the words in a way that frees you from the meanings that were originally intended to you with the words?
Right. So as the example, this wonderful, powerful woman who took those negative words and then took back that poison,
mm-hmm,
and made it into a bomb.
Freedom.
A freedom.
Right, into a freedom.
Like, oh, not only am I not offended, but I now empower myself,
right,
because of this negativity that this other person said.
Right.
So not only am I not trapped by it, but I'm growing from it.
Right.
What a great turnaround.
Yes.
I mean, she's just brilliant for being able to do that.
Yes.
And how do we all do that every day?
Well, one thing, too, is to just look into the nature of words themselves, or, you know, particularly words. And this is a great psychotherapeutic exercise, too, where, you know, the empty chair exercise.
Oh,
where,
I love
where
that.
People,
I'm a big gestalt person.
So where people say to themselves, to their prior selves, the words they always needed to hear and never got to hear. So adding words can be one mechanism of creating greater playfulness and spontaneity. So can, but then words can be used to go beyond what are called the eight snares of human existence in Tantra, which is shame, fear, envy, disgust, anger, lust, delusion, and I'm leaving one out, greed. Greed. So,
wow.
Yes, these are.
I gotta get that written down, because I talk about with every client essentially the four horsemen in our world. You know, judgment, shame, guilt, remorse.
Right.
And it's the same kind of notion of like, instead of getting our
snared by these things.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, we're the ones trapping ourselves.
We're trapped in our experience or the limitations of our experience. That, you know, as J.L. Moreno, who invented psychodrama, said, by the group we were wounded and by the group we shall be healed. That's great if you've got a group that will heal you. If you don't, it's going to have to be more of a solo project in terms of going beyond
these things. Or you do like psychodrama, which is a wonderful technique.
Yes.
Where you're essentially giving those words to the group around you to, in fact, speak back to you.
Right.
So you can hear, like, oh, yes, finally I could hear my mother saying how much she loves me. And I could essentially find myself freed from that experience.
Or the need for the experience you never had.
Exactly.
But in terms of freeing oneself from experiences one has had, particularly around sexuality, which is, you know, in addition to lust, sexuality often is imbued with anger and most strongly, I think, for many people, with shame. Because, you know, because we live in a culture that is descended from the Puritans, which were already a very sexually shamed people.
Yes.
And because people, you know, it's one of those places where shame gets transposed so easily, where people, like people who are rape victims, end up in a certain sense carrying the shame of the perpetrator. It, you know, it's a sort of way of, it can be a way of offloading shame onto someone else, where the secrecy surrounding, you know, negative sexual acts becomes a way to allow the receiver to be the holder of the shame for the perpetrator in, you know, in this sense of perpetrator victim. So I think each person has to make a determination for themselves about, you know, where healthy sexuality begins and ends and where rape or violence begins and ends for them in sexuality.
Or even if that occurred, again, that backside, what am I now recreating? Because trauma in my world isn't what happened to us. It's what we did to ourselves afterwards.
Well, it's not what we did to ourselves as a conscious act. It's what the mammalian nervous system does to the self. Because it, then, you know, that's the unfortunate vulnerability of being human, is that you live in a body-mind system that records your experiences and the emotions that accompany those experiences.
Biopsychosocial, we are literally mammals in a body.
Yes.
And we are experiencing something. And if we experience something as trauma, it's not like we had a choice.
Right.
I'm saying choice then comes in afterwards. Oh, I now acknowledge, I get the experience, I have some understanding, terrible experience. Now what do I stop re-traumatizing myself? The perpetrator isn't there. I'm the one now doing this to me.
Well, I'm not the one doing this to me. I now have an inner perpetrator recorded in my brain.
That's repeating itself over and I'm right. Doing a brain loop over and over again.
Right, which is why these more right brain modalities and these playful modalities, play therapy, reenactments in psychodrama,
yeah.
Somatic experiencing, where you also basically refeel the experience but give it a different ending that has a more empowered ending. That's why they're so effective. Because, but then there are these ways too that are more left-brained of consciously playing with meaning, of taking words and reclaiming them essentially by using them. Recontextualizing them, etc.
Excellent.
Which, you know, could be another take on narrative therapy. Additionally, though, to narrative therapy, there is an external narrative therapy, which is to align oneself with very old stories that have been retold through time. In India, therapeutic mythology is a big part of healing, in which even sometimes as a remedial measure for suffering, people will read a certain story repeatedly so that they can embody its meanings and thereby free themselves from, that's another way of freeing oneself from the limitations of one's personal narrative, is to borrow someone else's story.
Hmm. Lovely. Okay. I want to leave a couple minutes here for you to tell us about your journey and how it's progressing. And you could talk about in the same vein of what you're talking about with that language.
The narrative.
The narrative. The thought of transformation here. So tell us about your journey and how it fits into this whole process.
Okay. Let me see where to begin. So,
we only got a couple minutes left. We only got like 3 minutes here, but I you know, I want to give somebody the sense of adventure you're on and how people can experience and grow from that. And you said you're going to check in from where you're going.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that backside of that adventure and how all of us can help learn from your adventure.
Well, okay. So, you know, stories are, a lot of the way we construct reality is about the story we tell ourselves about who we are and or who we want to become.
And then what do we do with our stories?
And then what we do with our stories. But in one sense, we're trying to refine our story every day of our lives, you know, or our stories every day of our lives.
Lovely.
And so, you know, I, what can I say about this adventure? This adventure is an interweaving of many narratives that have influenced my life. And these narratives range from very, very high trauma to very high bliss. So to put it in a nutshell, in the little 2 minutes that we have, the essence of all of my experience of different narratives is the Tao, is that at the center of any woven story, there is a kernel of emptiness, which is freedom, really. That is the freedom to be in any narrative, is if you cognize that, that narratives, that there's always a little portal at the center of any narrative that is like a little escape hatch. You know, there's the way of remedying one narrative with another narrative or reworking that narrative. And then there's also this final notion of that everything is a narrative. And so there's a space beyond narrative. Jalaluddin Rumi, who's a famous Sufi mystic, said, "There's a field out beyond right and wrong. I'll meet you there." And so there's a field out beyond any duality. So we could say, in essence, I'm aiming for that field.
So you're leaving Fairfield.
Yes.
And you're going on this grand adventure.
Yes.
To New Mexico and Costa Rica.
Yes.
Which I am so psyched about and am going to be joining you soon, especially to Costa Rica, maybe.
Hooray!
I know. Especially depending on what happens here. But anyways, if people are interested in connecting, can they still connect with you?
Yes.
And they could still do a Jyotish reading, for instance?
Yes, I have a Skype account and a Skype phone number, so I'm still available via Skype
or
phone.
How would somebody connect with you?
Best way to initially get a hold of me is always through email.
And your email is?
My email is premavratini@yahoo.com, or if you can't spell premavratini, you can contact me at raa1008@gmail.com.
Oh, much easier. Okay, say that one again.
raa1008@gmail.com.
All right. And you could always contact me, scott@ardencenter.com, and I will put you in touch with Allison. And Allison, you're going to come back and tell us the backside of this journey, the new narrative, the escape hatch that you found,
yes,
and how we could allow other people to, again, reinvent themselves.
Selves.
Over and over again, because that's all we're doing in the relative, is always every day stop holding on, but allow yourself to find freedom in that reinvention.
Yes. Beautifully said, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. Mental Health Matters. Love you all. Bye.